He, on the other hand, told a funny story about how Nielsen had come home one night to discover the village idiot from across the bridge trying to break a window at the guest house. Nielsen went over to ask the half-witted delinquent why he didn't go in through the unlocked front door. Nielsen inspected Blomqvist's little TV with misgiving and invited him to come across their house if there was ever a program he wanted to see. Wanger stayed on briefly after the Nielsens left. He thought it best that Blomqvist sort through the files himself, and he could come to the house if he had any problems. When he was alone once more, Blomqvist carried the boxes into his office and made an inventory of the contents. Wanger's investigation into the disappearance of his brother's granddaughter had been going on for 36 years. Blomqvist wondered whether this was an unhealthy obsession or whether, over the years, it had developed into an intellectual game. What was clear was that the old patriarch had tackled the job with the systematic approach of an amateur archaeologist. The material was going to fill 20 feet of shelving. The largest section of it consisted of 26 binders, which were the copies of the police investigation. Hard to believe an ordinary missing person case would have produced such comprehensive material. Wanger no doubt had enough clout to keep the Hedestad police following up both plausible and implausible leads. Then there were scrapbooks, photograph albums, maps, texts about Hedestad and the Wanger firm, Harriet's diary, though it did not contain many pages, her schoolbooks, medical certificates. There were 16 bound A4 volumes of 100 or so pages each, which were Wanger's logbook of the investigations. In these notebooks he had recorded, in an impeccable hand, his own speculations, theories, digressions. Blomqvist leafed through them. The text had a literary quality, and he had the feeling that these texts were fair copies of perhaps many more notebooks. There were 10 binders containing material on members of the Wanger family. These pages were typed and had been compiled over the intervening years, Wanger's investigations of his own family. Around 7, he heard a loud meowing at the front door. A reddish-brown cat slipped swiftly past him into the warmth. "Wise cat," he said. The cat sniffed around the guest house for a while. Mikhail poured some milk into a dish and his guest lapped it up. Then the cat hopped onto the kitchen bench and curled up. And there she stayed. It was after 10 before Blomqvist had the scope of the material clear in his mind and had arranged it on the shelves. He put on a pot of coffee and made himself 2 sandwiches. He had not eaten a proper meal all day, but he was strangely uninterested in food. He offered the cat a piece of sausage and some liverwurst. After drinking his coffee, he took the cigarettes out of his jacket pocket and opened the pack. He checked his mobile. Berger had not called. He tried her once more. Again, only her voicemail. One of the first steps Blomqvist had taken was to scan in the map of Hedeby Island that he had borrowed from Wanger. While all the names were still fresh in his mind, he wrote down who lived in each house. The Wanger clan consisted of such an extensive caste that it would take time to learn who was who. Just before midnight he put on warm clothes and his new shoes and walked across the bridge. He turned off the road and along the sound below the church. Ice had formed on the sound and inside the old harbour, but farther out he could see a darker belt of open water. As he stood there, the lights on the façade of the church went out and it was dark all around him. It was icy cold and stars filled the sky. All of a sudden Blomqvist felt depressed. He could not, for the life of him, understand how he had allowed Wanger to talk him into taking on this assignment. Berger was right. He should be in Stockholm, in bed with her, for instance, and planning his campaigns against Wennerström. But he felt apathetic about that, too, and he didn't even have the faintest idea how to begin planning a counter-strategy. Had it been daylight, he would have walked straight to Wanger's house, cancelled his contract, and gone home. But from the rise beside the church he could make out all the houses on the island side. Harold Wanger's house was dark, but there were lights on in Cecilia's home, as well as in Martin's villa out by the point and in the house that was leased. In the small boat harbour there were lights on in the draughty cabin of the artist, and little clouds of sparks were rising from his chimney. There were also lights on in the top floor of the café, and Blomqvist wondered whether Suzanne lived there, and if so, whether she was alone. On Sunday morning he awoke in panic at the incredible din that filled the guest house. It took him a second to get his bearings and realize that it was the church bells summoning parishioners to morning service. It was nearly 11. He stayed in bed until he heard an urgent meowing in the doorway, and he got up to let out the cat. By noon he had showered and eaten breakfast. He went resolutely into his office and took down the first binder from the police investigation. Then he hesitated. From the gable window he could see Suzanne's Bridge Café. He stuffed the binder into his shoulder bag and put on his outdoor clothes. When he reached the café, he found it brimming with customers, and there he had the answer to a question that had been in the back of his mind. How could a café survive in a backwater like Hedeby? Suzanne specialized in churchgoers and presumably did coffee and cakes for funerals and other functions. He took a walk instead. Consum was closed on Sundays, and he continued a few hundred yards towards Hedestad, where he bought newspapers at a petrol station. He spent an hour walking about Hedeby, familiarizing himself with the town before the bridge. The area closest to the church and past Consum was the centre, with older buildings, two-storey stone structures which Blomqvist guessed had been built in the 1910s or 20s, and which formed a short main street. North of the road into town were well-kept apartment buildings for families with children. Along the water and to the south of the church were mostly single-family homes. Hedeby looked to be a relatively well-to-do area for Hedestad's decision-makers and civil servants. When he returned to the bridge, the assault on the café had ebbed, but Suzanne was still clearing dishes from the table. "The Sunday rush," he said in greeting. She nodded as she tucked a lock of hair behind one ear.
"Hi, Mikael."
"So you remember my name?"
"Hard to forget," she said. "I followed your trial on TV."
"They have to fill up the news with something," he muttered, and drifted over to the corner table with a view of the bridge. When he met Suzanne's eyes, she smiled.
At 3, Suzanne announced that she was closing the café for the day. After the church rush, only a few customers had come and gone. Blomqvist had read more than a fifth of the first binder of the police investigation. He stuck his notebook into his bag and walked briskly home across the bridge. The cat was waiting on the steps. He looked around, wondering whose cat it was. He let it inside all the same, since the cat was at least some sort of company. He made one more vain attempt to reach Berga. Obviously she was furious with him still. He could have tried calling her direct line at the office or her home number, but he had already left enough messages. Instead, he made himself coffee, moved the cat farther along the kitchen bench, and opened the binder on the table. He read carefully and slowly, not wanting to miss any detail. By late evening, when he closed the binder, he had filled several pages of his own notebook, with reminders and questions to which he hoped to find answers in subsequent binders. The material was all arranged in chronological order. He could not tell whether Wanger had reorganized it that way, or whether that was the system used by the police at the time. The first page was a photocopy of a handwritten report form, headed Hedestad Police Emergency Centre. The officer who had taken the call had signed his name D.O. Rittinger, and Blomqvist assumed the D.O. stood for Duty Officer. The caller was Henrik Wanger. His address and telephone number had been noted. The report was dated Sunday, September 25th, 1966, at 11:14 a.m. The text was laconic. Call from Henrik Wanger stating that his brother's daughter, Harriet Ulrika Wanger, born 15th January 1950, age 16, has been missing from her home on Hedeby Island since Saturday afternoon. The caller expressed great concern. A note sent at 11:20 a.m. stated that P-014, police car, patrol, pilot of a boat, had been sent to the site. Another at 11:35 a.m. in a less legible hand than Rittinger's inserted that Officer Magnusson reports that bridge to Hedeby Island still blocked, transp by boat. In the margin, an illegible signature. At 12:14 p.m. Rittinger is back. Telephone conversation, Officer Magnusson in HB confirms that 16-year-old Harriet Wanger missing since early Saturday afternoon. Family expressed great concern. Not believed to have slept in her bed last night, could not have left island due to blocked bridge. None of family members has any knowledge as to HV's whereabouts. At 12:19 p.m., GM informed by telephone about the situation. The last note was recorded at 1:42 p.m. GM on site at HB. We'll take over the matter. The next page revealed that the initials GM referred to Detective Inspector Gustav Morel, who arrived at Hedeby Island by boat and there took over command, preparing a formal report on the disappearance of Harriet Wanger. Unlike the initial notations with their needless abbreviations, Morel's reports were written on a typewriter and in very readable prose. The following pages recounted what measures had been taken, with an objectivity and wealth of detail that surprised Blomqvist. Morel had first interviewed Henrik Wanger, along with Isabella Wanger, Harriet's mother. Then he talked in turn with Ulrika Wanger, Harold Wanger, Gregor Wanger, Harriet's brother Martin Wanger, and Anita Wanger. Blomqvist came to the conclusion that these interviews had been conducted according to a scale of decreasing importance. Ulrika Wanger was Henrik Wanger's mother, and evidently she held a status comparable to that of a dowager queen. Ulrika lived at the Wanger estate and was able to provide no information. She had gone to bed early on the previous night and had not seen Harriet for several days. She appeared to have insisted on meeting Detective Inspector Morel solely to give air to her opinion that the police had to act at once, immediately. Harold Wanger ranked as number two on the list. He had seen Harriet only briefly when she returned from the festivities in Hedestad, but he had not seen her since the accident on the bridge occurred, and he had no knowledge of where she might be at present. Gregor Wanger, brother of Henrik and Harold, stated that he had seen the missing 16-year-old in Henrik Wanger's study, asking to speak with Henrik after her visit to Hedestad earlier in the day. Gregor Wanger stated that he had not spoken with her himself, merely given her a greeting. He had no idea where she might be found, but he expressed the view that she had probably, thoughtlessly, gone to visit some friend, without telling anyone, and would reappear soon. When asked how she might in that case have left the island, he offered no answer. Martin Wanger was interviewed in a cursory fashion. He was in his final year at the preparatory school in Uppsala, where he lived in the home of Harold Wanger. There was no room for him in Harold's car, so he had taken the train home to Hedeby, arriving so late that he was stranded on the wrong side of the bridge accident and could not cross until late in the evening by boat. He was interviewed in the hope that his sister might have confided in him, and perhaps given him some clue if she was thinking of running away. The question was met with protests from Harriet Wanger's mother, but at that moment Inspector Morel was perhaps thinking that Harriet's having run away would be the best they could hope for. But Martin had not spoken with his sister since the summer holiday, and had no information of value. Anita Wanger, daughter of Harold Wanger, was erroneously listed as Harriet's first cousin. She was in her first year at the university in Stockholm, and had spent the summer in Hedeby. She was almost the same age as Harriet, and they had become close friends. She stated that she had arrived at the island with her father on Saturday and was looking forward to seeing Harriet, but she had not had the opportunity to find her. Anita stated that she felt uneasy, and that it was not like Harriet to go off without telling the family. Henrik and Isabella Wanger confirmed that this was the case. While Inspector Morel was interviewing family members, he had told Magnusson and Bergman, Patrol 014, to organize the first search party while there was still daylight. The bridge was still closed to traffic, so it was difficult to call in reinforcements. The group consisted of about 30 available individuals, men and women of varying ages. The areas they searched that afternoon included the unoccupied houses at the fishing harbour, the shoreline at the point and along the sound, the section of woods closest to the village, and the hill called Söderberget, behind the fishing harbour. The latter was searched because someone had put forward the theory that Harriet might have gone up there to get a good view of the scene on the bridge. Patrols were also sent out to Östergården and to Gottfried's cabin on the other side of the island, which Harriet occasionally visited. But the search was fruitless. It was not called off until long after dark fell, at 10 at night. The temperature overnight dropped to freezing. During the afternoon, Inspector Morel set up his headquarters in a drawing room that Henrik Wanger had put at his disposal on the ground floor of the Wanger estate office. He had undertaken a number of measures. In the company of Isabella Wanger, he had examined Harriet's room and tried to ascertain whether anything was missing, clothes, a suitcase, or the like, which would indicate that Harriet had run away from home. Isabella, a note implied, had not been helpful and did not seem to be familiar with her daughter's wardrobe. "She often wore jeans, but they all look the same, don't they?" Harriet's purse was on her desk. It contained ID, a wallet holding 9 kronor and 50 öre, a comb, a mirror, and a handkerchief. After the inspection, Harriet's room was locked. Morell had summoned more people to be interviewed, family members and employees. All the interviews were meticulously reported. When the participants in the first search party began returning with disheartening reports, the inspector decided that a more systematic search had to be made. That evening and night, reinforcements were called in. Morell contacted, among others, the chairman of Hedestad's Orienteering Club, and appealed for help in summoning volunteers for the search party. By midnight, he was told that 53 members, mostly from the junior division, would be at the Wanger estate at 7 the next morning. Henrik Wanger called in part of the morning shift, numbering 50 men from the paper mill. He also arranged for food and drink for them all. Blomqvist could vividly imagine the scenes played out at the Wanger estate during those days. The accident on the bridge had certainly contributed to the confusion during the first hours, by making it difficult to bring in reinforcements, and also because people somehow thought that these two dramatic events, happening at the same place and close to the same time, must in some way have been connected. When the tanker truck was hoisted away, Inspector Morell went down to the bridge to be sure that Harriet Wanger had not, by some unlikely turn of events, ended up under the wreck. That was the only irrational action that Mikhail could detect in the inspector's conduct, since the missing girl had unquestionably been seen on the island after the accident had occurred. During those first, confused 24 hours, their hopes that the situation would come to a swift and happy resolution sank. Instead, they were gradually replaced by two theories. In spite of the obvious difficulties in leaving the island unnoticed, Morell refused to discount the possibility that she had run away. He decided that an all-points bulletin should be sent out for Harriet Wanger, and he gave instructions for the patrol officers in Hedestad to keep their eyes open for the missing girl. He also sent a colleague in the criminal division to interview bus drivers and staff at the railway station, to find out whether anyone might have seen her. As the negative reports came in, it became increasingly likely that Harriet Wanger had fallen victim to some sort of misfortune. This theory ended up dominating the investigative work of the following days. The big search party, 2 days after her disappearance, was apparently, as far as Blomqvist could tell, carried out effectively. Police and firefighters, who had experience with similar operations, had organized the search. Hedeby Island did have some parts that were almost inaccessible, but it was nevertheless a small area, and the island was searched with a fine-tooth comb in one day. A police boat and 2 volunteer Pettersson boats did what they could to search the waters around the island. On the following day, the search was continued, with decreased manpower. Patrols were sent out to make a second sweep of the particularly rugged terrain, as well as an area known as the Fortress, a now-abandoned bunker system that was built during the Second World War. That day they also searched cubby holes, wells, vegetable cellars, outhouses, and attics in the village. A certain frustration could be read in the official notes when the search was called off on the third day after the girl's disappearance. Morell was, of course, not yet aware of it, but at that moment he had actually reached as far in the investigation as he would ever get. He was puzzled and struggled to identify the natural next step or any place where the search ought to be pursued. Harriet Wanger seemed to have dissolved into thin air, and Henrik Wanger's years of torment had begun. Chapter 9. Monday, January 6th to Wednesday, January 8th. Blomqvist kept reading until the small hours and did not get up until late on Epiphany Day. A navy blue late-model Volvo was parked outside Wanger's house. Even as he reached for the door handle, the door was opened by a man on his way out. They almost collided. The man seemed to be in a hurry.
"Yes? Can I help you?"
"I'm here to see Henrik Wanger," Blomqvist said. The man's eyes brightened. He smiled and stuck out his hand.
"You must be Mikhail Blomqvist, the one who's going to help Henrik with the family chronicle, right?"
They shook hands. Wanger had apparently begun spreading Blomqvist's cover story. The man was overweight, the result, no doubt, of too many years of negotiating in offices and conference rooms, but Blomqvist noticed at once the likeness, the similarity between his face and Harriet Wanger's.
"I'm Martin Wanger," the man said. "Welcome to Hedestad."
"Thank you.
I saw you on TV a while ago. Everybody seems to have seen me on TV. Venestrom is not very popular in this house.
Henrik mentioned that. I'm waiting to hear the rest of the story.
He told me a few days ago that he'd hired you.
Martin Wanger laughed.
He said it was probably because of Venestrom that you took the job up here.
Blomqvist hesitated before deciding to tell the truth.
Well, that was one important reason. But to be honest, I needed to get away from Stockholm, and Hedestad cropped up at the right moment.
At least I think so. I can't pretend that the court case never happened. And anyway, I'm going to have to go to prison. Martin Wanger nodded, suddenly serious.
Can you appeal?
It won't do any good. Wanger glanced at his watch.
I have to be in Stockholm tonight, so I must hurry away. I'll be back in a few days. Come over and have dinner. I'd really like to hear what actually went on during that trial. Henrik is upstairs. Go right in.
Wanger was sitting on a sofa in his office, where he had the Hedestad Courier, Dagens Industri, Svenska Dagbladet, and both national evening papers on the coffee table.
I ran into Martin outside.
Rushing off to save the Empire, Wanger said. Coffee?
Yes, please.
Blomqvist sat down, wondering why Wanger looked so amused.
You're mentioned in the paper.
Wanger shoved across one of the evening papers, open at a page with the headline, Media Short Circuit. The article was written by a columnist who had previously worked for Monopoly Financial magazine, making a name for himself as one who cheerfully ridiculed everyone who felt passionate about any issue or who stuck their neck out. Feminists, anti-racists, and environmental activists could all reckon on receiving their share. The writer was not known for espousing a single conviction of his own. Now, several weeks after the trial in the Venestrom affair, he was bringing his fire to bear on Mikael Blomqvist, whom he described as a complete idiot. Erika Berger was portrayed as an incompetent media bimbo.
A rumor is circulating that Millennium is on the verge of collapse, in spite of the fact that the editor-in-chief is a feminist who wears miniskirts and pouts her lips on TV. For several years the magazine has survived on the image that has been successfully marketed by editors, young reporters who undertake investigative journalism and expose the scoundrels of the business world. This advertising trick may work with young anarchists who want to hear just such a message, but it doesn't wash in the district court, as Kalle Blomqvist recently found out.
Blomqvist switched on his mobile and checked to see if he had any calls from Berger. There were no messages. Wanger waited without saying anything. Blomqvist realized that the old man was allowing him to break the silence.
"He's a moron," Blomqvist said.
Wanger laughed, but he said,
"That may be, but he's not the one who was sentenced by the court."
"That's true. And he never will be. He never says anything original. He always just jumps on the bandwagon and casts the final stone in the most damaging terms he can get away with."
"I've had many enemies over the years. If there's one thing I've learned, it's never engage in a fight you're sure to lose. On the other hand, never let anyone who has insulted you get away with it. Bide your time, and strike back when you're in a position of strength, even if you no longer need to strike back."
"Thank you for your wisdom, Henrik. Now I'd like you to tell me about your family."
He set the tape recorder between them on the table and pressed the record button.
"What do you want to know?"
"I've read through the first binder about the disappearance and the searches, but there are so many Wangers mentioned that I need your help identifying them all."
For nearly 10 minutes, Salander stood in the empty hall with her eyes fixed on the brass plaque that said, "Advocate N. E. Bjurman," before she rang the bell. The lock on the entry door clicked. It was Tuesday. It was their second meeting. And she had a bad feeling about it. She was not afraid of Bjurman. Salander was rarely afraid of anyone or anything. On the other hand, she felt uncomfortable with this new guardian. His predecessor, Advocate Holger Palmgren, had been of an entirely different ilk, courteous and kind. But 3 months ago Palmgren had had a stroke, and Niels Erik Bjurman had inherited her in accordance with some bureaucratic pecking order. In the 12 years that Salander had been under social and psychiatric guardianship, 2 of those years in a children's clinic, she had never once given the same answer to the simple question, "So how are you today?" When she turned 13, the court had decided, under laws governing the guardianship of minors, that she should be entrusted to the locked ward of St. Stephen's Psychiatric Clinic for Children in Uppsala. The decision was primarily based on the fact that she was deemed to be emotionally disturbed and dangerously violent towards her classmates and possibly towards herself. All attempts by a teacher or any authority figure to initiate a conversation with the girl about her feelings, emotional life, or the state of her health were met, to their great frustration, with a sullen silence and a great deal of intense staring at the floor, ceiling, and walls. She would fold her arms and refuse to participate in any psychological tests. Her resistance to all attempts to measure, weigh, chart, analyze, or educate her applied also to her schoolwork. The authorities could have her carried to a classroom and could chain her to the bench, but they could not stop her from closing her ears and refusing to lift a pen to write anything. She completed the 9 years of compulsory schooling without a certificate. This had consequently become associated with a great difficulty of even diagnosing her mental deficiencies. In short, Lisbeth Salander was anything but easy to handle. By the time she was 13, it was also decided that a trustee should be assigned to take care of her interests and assets until she came of age. This trustee was Advocate Palmgren, who, in spite of a rather difficult start, had succeeded where psychiatrists and doctors had failed. Gradually, he won not only a certain amount of trust, but also a modest amount of warmth from the girl. When she turned 15, the doctors had more or less agreed that she was not, after all, dangerously violent, nor did she represent any immediate danger to herself. Her family had been categorized as dysfunctional, and she had no relatives who could look after her welfare, so it was decided that Lisbeth Salander should be released from the psychiatric clinic for children in Uppsala and eased back into society by way of a foster family. That had not been an easy journey. She ran away from the first foster family after only 2 weeks. The second and third foster families fell by the wayside in quick succession. At that point, Palmgren had a serious discussion with her, explaining bluntly that if she persisted on this path, she would be institutionalized again. This threat had the effect that she accepted foster family number 4, an elderly couple who lived in Midsommerkransen. But it did not mean, however, that she behaved herself. At the age of 17, Salander was arrested by the police on 4 occasions. Twice she was so intoxicated that she ended up in the emergency room, and once she was plainly under the influence of narcotics. On one of these occasions she was found dead drunk, with her clothes in disarray, in the back seat of a car parked at Södra Mellstrand. She was with an equally drunk and much older man. The last arrest occurred 3 weeks before her 18th birthday, when she, perfectly sober, kicked a male passenger in the head inside the gates of the Gamla Stan Tunnelbana station. She was charged with assault and battery. Salander claimed that the man had groped her, and her testimony was supported by witnesses. The prosecutor dismissed the case, but her background was such that the district court ordered a psychiatric evaluation. Since she refused, as was her custom, to answer any questions or to participate in the examinations, the doctors consulted by the National Board of Health and Welfare handed down an opinion based on observations of the patient. It was unclear precisely what could be observed when it was a matter of a silent young woman sitting on a chair with her arms folded and her lower lip stuck out. The only determination made was that she must suffer from some kind of emotional disturbance, whose nature was of the sort that could not be left untreated. The medical legal report recommended care in a closed psychiatric institution. An assistant head of the Social Welfare Board wrote an opinion in support of the conclusions of the psychiatric experts. With regard to her personal record, the opinion concluded that there was grave risk of alcohol and drug abuse, and that she lacked self-awareness. By then her casebook was filled with terms such as introverted, socially inhibited, lacking in empathy, ego-fixated, psychopathic and asocial behavior, difficulty in cooperating, and incapable of assimilating learning. Anyone who read her casebook might be tempted to conclude that Salander was seriously retarded. Another mark against her was that the social services street patrol had on several occasions observed her with various men in the area around Mariatorget. She was once stopped and frisked in Tantalunden, again with a much older man. It was feared that Salander was possibly operating as, or ran the risk of becoming, a prostitute. When the district court, the institution that would determine her future, met to decide on the matter, the outcome seemed a foregone conclusion. She was obviously a problem child, and it was unlikely that the court would come to any decision other than to accept the recommendations of both the psychiatric and the social inquiries. On the morning the court hearing was to take place, Salander was brought from the psychiatric clinic for children, where she had been confined since the incident in Gamlestan. She felt like a prisoner from a concentration camp. She had no hope of surviving the day. The first person she saw in the courtroom was Palmgren, and it took a while for her to realize that he was not there in the role of a trustee, but rather as her legal representative. To her surprise, he was firmly in her corner, and he made a powerful appeal against institutionalization. She did not betray with so much as a raised eyebrow that she was surprised, but she listened intently to every word that was said. Palmgren was brilliant during the 2 hours in which he cross-examined the physician, a Dr. Jesper H. Lodemann, who had signed his name to the recommendation that Salander be locked away in an institution. Every detail of the opinion was scrutinized, and the doctor was required to explain the scientific basis for each statement. Eventually, it became clear that since the patient had refused to complete a single test, the basis for the doctor's conclusions was in fact nothing more than guesswork. At the end of the hearing, Palmgren intimated that compulsory institutionalization was in all probability not only contrary to Parliament's decisions in similar situations, but in this particular case it might, in addition, be the subject of political and media reprisals. So it was in everyone's interest to find an appropriate alternative solution. Such language was unusual for negotiations in this type of situation, and the members of the court had squirmed nervously. The solution was also a compromise. The court concluded that Lisbeth Salander was indeed emotionally disturbed, but that her condition did not necessarily warrant internment. On the other hand, the social welfare director's recommendation of guardianship was taken under consideration. The chairman of the court turned with a venomous smile to Holger Palmgren, who up until then had been her trustee, and inquired whether he might be willing to take on the guardianship. The chairman obviously thought that Palmgren would back away and try to push the responsibility onto someone else. On the contrary, Palmgren declared that he would be happy to take on the job of serving as Fröken Salander's guardian, but on one condition. That Fröken Salander must be willing to trust me, and accept me as her guardian. He turned to face her. Lisbeth Salander was somewhat bewildered by the exchange that had gone back and forth over her head all day. Until now, no one had asked for her opinion. She looked at Holger Palmgren for a long time, and then nodded once. Palmgren was a peculiar mixture of jurist and social worker of the old school. At first he had been a politically appointed member of the Social Welfare Board, and he had spent nearly all his life dealing with problem youths. A reluctant sense of respect, almost bordering on friendship, had in time formed between Palmgren and his ward, who was unquestionably the most difficult he had ever had to deal with. Their relationship had lasted 11 years, from her 13th birthday until the previous year, when a few weeks before Christmas she had gone to see Palmgren at home after he missed one of their scheduled monthly meetings. When he did not open the door, even though she could hear sounds coming from his apartment, she broke in by climbing up a drainpipe to the balcony on the 4th floor. She found him lying on the floor in the hall, conscious, but unable to speak or move. She called for an ambulance and accompanied him to Söder Hospital with a growing feeling of panic in her stomach. For 3 days she hardly left the corridor outside the intensive care unit. Like a faithful watchdog, she kept an eye on every doctor and nurse who went in or out of the door. She wandered up and down the corridor like a lost soul, fixing her eyes on every doctor who came near. Finally, a doctor whose name she never discovered took her into a room to explain the gravity of the situation. Herr Palmgren was in critical condition, following a severe cerebral hemorrhage. He was not expected to regain consciousness. He was only 64 years old. She neither wept nor changed her expression. She stood up, left the hospital, and did not return. 5 weeks later, the guardianship agency summoned Salander to the first meeting with her new guardian.
Her initial impulse was to ignore the summons, but Palmgren had imprinted in her consciousness that every action has its consequences. She had learned to analyze the consequences, and so she had come to the conclusion that the easiest way out of this present dilemma was to satisfy the guardianship agency by behaving as if she cared about what they had to say. Thus, in December, taking a break from her research on Mikael Blomkvist, she arrived at Bjurman's office on St. Eriksplan, where an elderly woman representing the board had handed over Salander's extensive file to Advocate Bjurman. The woman had kindly asked Salander how things were going, and she seemed satisfied with the stifled silence she received in reply. After about half an hour, she left Salander in the care of Advocate Bjurman. Salander decided that she did not like Advocate Bjurman. She studied him furtively as he read through her casebook. Age, over 50. Trim body, tennis on Tuesdays and Fridays. Blonde, thinning hair, a slight cleft in his chin. Hugo Boss aftershave, blue suit, red tie with a gold tie-pin, and ostentatious cufflinks with the initials N.E.B. Steel-rimmed glasses, grey eyes. To judge by the magazines on the side table, his interests were hunting and shooting. During the years she had known Palmgren, he had always offered her coffee and chatted with her. Not even her worst escapes from foster homes or her regular truancy from school had ever ruffled his composure. The only time Palmgren had been really upset was when she had been charged with assault and battery after that scumbag had groped her in Gamlestan. "Do you understand what you've done? You harmed another human being, Lisbeth." He had sounded like an old teacher, and she had patiently ignored every word of his scolding. Bjurman did not have time for small talk. He had immediately concluded that there was a discrepancy between Palmgren's obligations according to the regulations of guardianship and the fact that he had apparently allowed the Salander girl to take charge of her own household and finances. Bjurman started in on a sort of interrogation. "How much do you earn? I want a copy of your financial records. Who do you spend time with? Do you pay your rent on time? Do you drink? Did Palmgren approve of those rings you have on your face? Are you careful about hygiene?" Fuck you. Palmgren had become her trustee right after all the evil had happened. He had insisted on meetings with her at least once a month, sometimes more often. After she moved back to Lundegarten, they were also practically neighbours. He lived on Hornsgarten, a couple of blocks away, and they would run into each other and go for coffee at Giffey's or some other cafe nearby. Palmgren had never tried to impose, but a few times he had visited her, bringing some little gift for her birthday. She had a standing invitation to visit him whenever she liked, a privilege that she seldom took advantage of. But when she moved to Söder, she had started spending Christmas Eve with him after she went to see her mother. They would eat Christmas ham and play chess. She had no real interest in the game, but after she learned the rules, she never lost a match. He was a widower, and Salander had seen it as her duty to take pity on him on those lonely holidays. She considered herself in his debt, and she always paid her debts. It was Palmgren who had sublet her mother's apartment on Lundegarten for her until Salander needed her own place to live. The apartment was about 500 square feet, shabby and unrenovated, but at least it was a roof over her head. Now Palmgren was gone, and another tie to established society had been severed. Nils Bjurman was a wholly different sort of person. No way she would be spending Christmas Eve at his house. His first move had been to put in place new rules on the management of her account at Handelsbanken. Palmgren had never had any problems about bending the conditions of his guardianship so as to allow her to take care of her own finances. She paid her bills and could use her savings as she saw fit. Prior to the meeting with Bjurman the week before Christmas, she had prepared herself. Once there, she had tried to explain that his predecessor had trusted her and had never been given occasion to do otherwise. Palmgren had let her take care of her own affairs and not interfered in her life. "That's one of the problems," Bjurman said, tapping her casebook. He then made a long speech about the rules and government regulations on guardianship. "He let you run free, is that it? I wonder how he got away with it."
"Because he was a crazy social democrat who had worked with troubled kids all his life."
"I'm not a child anymore,"
Salander said, as if that were explanation enough.
"No,
You're not a child. But I've been appointed your guardian, and as long as I have that role, I am legally and financially responsible for you.
He opened a new account in her name, and she was supposed to report it to Milton's personnel office and use it from now on. The good old days were over. In future, Bierman would pay her bills, and she would be given an allowance each month. He told her that he expected her to provide receipts for all her expenses. She would receive 1,400 kronor a week, for food, clothing, film tickets, and such like. Salander earned more than 160,000 kroner a year. She could double that by working full-time and accepting all the assignments Armansky offered her. But she had few expenses and did not need much money. The cost of her apartment was about 2,000 kroner a month, and in spite of her modest income, she had 90,000 kroner in her savings account. But she no longer had access to it.
"This has to do with the fact that I'm responsible for your money," he said. "You have to put money aside for the future, but don't worry. I'll take care of all that."
"I've taken care of myself since I was 10, you creep."
"You function well enough in social terms that you don't need to be institutionalized, but this society is responsible for you."
He questioned her closely about what kind of work assignments she was given at Milton Security. She had instinctively lied about her duties. The answer she gave him was a description of her very first weeks at Milton. Muirman got the impression that she made coffee and sorted the post, suitable enough tasks for someone who was a little slow, and seemed satisfied. She did not know why she had lied, but she was sure it was a wise decision. Blomqvist had spent 5 hours with Wanger, and it took much of the night and all of Tuesday to type up his notes and piece together the genealogy into a comprehensible whole. The family history that emerged was a dramatically different version from the one presented as the official image of the family. Every family had a few skeletons in their cupboards, but the Wanger family had an entire gallimaufry of them. Blomqvist had had to remind himself several times that his real assignment was not to write a biography of the Wanger family, but find out what happened to Harriet Wanger. The Wanger biography would be no more than playing to the gallery. After a year he would receive his preposterous salary. The contract drawn up by Froda had been signed. His true reward, he hoped, would be the information about Wennerström that Wanger claimed to possess. But after listening to Wanger, he began to see that the year did not have to be a waste of time. A book about the Wanger family had significant value. It was, quite simply, a terrific story. The idea that he might light upon Harriet Wanger's killer never crossed his mind, assuming she had been murdered, that is, and did not just die in some freak accident. Blomqvist agreed with Wanger that the chances of a 16-year-old girl going off of her own accord and then staying hidden for 36 years, despite the oversight of all the government bureaucracy, were non-existent. On the other hand, he did not exclude the possibility that Harriet Wanger had run away, maybe heading for Stockholm, and that something had befallen her subsequently. Drugs, prostitution, an assault, or an accident, pure and simple. Wanger was convinced, for his part, that Harriet had been murdered, and that a family member was responsible, possibly in collaboration with someone else. His argument was based on the fact that Harriet had disappeared during the confusion in the hours when the island was cut off, and all eyes were directed at the accident. Berger had been right to say that his taking the assignment was beyond all common sense if the goal was to solve a murder mystery. But Blomqvist was beginning to see that Harriet's fate had played a central role in the family, and especially for Henrik Wanger. No matter whether he was right or wrong, Wanger's accusation against his relatives was of great significance in the family's history. The accusation had been aired openly for more than 30 years, and it had coloured the family gatherings, and given rise to poisonous animosities that had contributed to destabilising the corporation. A study of Harriet's disappearance would consequently function as a chapter all on its own, as well as provide a red thread through the family history. And there was an abundance of source material. One starting point, whether Harriet Wanger was his primary assignment or whether he made do with writing a family chronicle, would be to map out the gallery of characters. That was the gist of his first long conversation that day with Wanger. The family consisted of about 100 individuals, counting all the children of cousins and second cousins. The family was so extensive that he was forced to create a database in his iBook. He used the notepad program, www.ibrium.se, one of those full-value products that two men at the Royal Technical College had created and distributed as shareware for a pittance on the Internet. Few programs were as useful for an investigative journalist. Each family member was given his or her own document in the database. The family tree could be traced back to the early 16th century, when the name was Vangirsad. According to Wanger, the name may have originated from the Dutch Van Gierstad. If that was the case, the lineage could be traced as far back as the 12th century. In modern times, the family came from northern France, arriving in Sweden with King Jean-Baptiste Bernadotte in the early 19th century. Alexandre Vangirsad was a soldier, and not personally acquainted with the king, but he had distinguished himself as the capable head of a garrison. In 1818, he was given the Hedeby estate as a reward for his service. Alexandre Vangirsad also had his own fortune, which he used to purchase considerable sections of forested land in Norrland. His son, Adrian, was born in France, but at his father's request he moved to Hedeby in that remote area of Norrland, far from the salons of Paris, to take over the administration of the estate. He took up farming and forestry, using new methods imported from Europe, and he founded the pulp and paper mill around which Hedestad was built. Alexandre's grandson was named Henrik, and he shortened his surname to Wanger. He developed trade with Russia and created a small merchant fleet of schooners that served the Baltics and Germany, as well as England with its steel industry during the mid-1800s. The elder Henrik Wanger diversified the family enterprises and founded a modest mining business, as well as several of Norrland's first metal industries. He left two sons, Birger and Gottfried, and they were the ones who laid the basis for the high-finance Wanger clan.
"Do you know anything about the old inheritance laws?"
Wanger had asked.
"No."
"I'm confused about it, too. According to family tradition, Birger and Gottfried fought like cats. They were legendary competitors for power and influence over the family business. In many respects, the power struggle threatened the very survival of the company. For that reason, their father decided, shortly before he died, to create a system whereby all members of the family would receive a portion of the inheritance, a share, in the business. It was no doubt well-intentioned, but it led to a situation in which, instead of being able to bring in skilled people and possible partners from the outside, we had a board of directors consisting only of family members."
"And that applies today?"
"Precisely. If a family member wishes to sell his shares, they have to stay within the family. Today the annual shareholders' meeting consists of 50% family members. Martin holds more than 10% of the shares. I have 5% after selling some of my shares, to Martin among others. My brother Harold owns 7%, but most of the people who come to the shareholders' meeting have only 1 or 0.5%.
"It sounds medieval in some ways."
"It's ludicrous. It means that today, if Martin wants to implement some policy, he has to waste time on a lobbying operation to ensure support from at least 20% to 25% of the shareholders. It's a patchwork quilt of alliances, factions, and intrigues."
Wanger resumed the history.
"Gottfried Wanger died childless in 1901. Or rather, may I be forgiven, he was the father of four daughters. But in those days women didn't really count. They owned shares, but it was the men in the family who constituted the ownership interest. It wasn't until women won the right to vote well into the 20th century that they were even allowed to attend the shareholders' meetings."
"Very liberal."
"No need to be sarcastic. Those were different times. At any rate, Gottfried's brother, Birger Wanger, had three sons, Johann, Frederick, and Gideon Wanger. They were all born towards the end of the 19th century. We can ignore Gideon. He sold his shares and emigrated to America. There is still a branch of the family over there. But Johann and Frederick Wanger made the company the modern Wanger Corporation."
Wanger took out a photograph album and showed Blomqvist pictures from the gallery of characters as he talked. The photographs from the early 1900s showed two men with sturdy chins and plastered-down hair who stared into the camera lens without a hint of a smile.
"Johann Wanger was the genius of the family. He trained as an engineer, and he developed the manufacturing industry with several new inventions, which he patented. Steel and iron became the basis of the firm, but the business also expanded into other areas, including textiles. Johann Wanger died in 1956, and had three daughters, Sophia, Merit, and Ingrid, who were the first women automatically to win admittance to the company's shareholders' meetings. The other brother, Frederik Wanger, was my father. He was a businessman and industry leader who transformed Johan's inventions into income. My father lived until 1964. He was active in company management right up until his death, although he had turned over daily operations to me in the 50s. It was exactly like the preceding generation, but in reverse. Johan had only daughters. Wanger showed Blomqvist pictures of big, busted women with wide-brimmed hats and carrying parasols. And Frederick, my father, had only sons. We were five brothers. Richard, Harold, Gregor, Gustav, and myself. Blomqvist had drawn up a family tree on several sheets of A4 paper taped together. He underlined the names of all those on Hedeby Island for the family meeting in 1966, and thus, at least theoretically, who could have had something to do with Harriet Wanger's disappearance. He left out children under the age of 12. He had to draw the line somewhere. After some pondering, he also left out Henrik Wanger. If the patriarch had had anything to do with the disappearance of his brother's granddaughter, his actions over the past 36 years would fall into the psychopathic arena. Wanger's mother, who in 1966 was already 81, could reasonably also be eliminated. Remaining were 23 family members who, according to Wanger, had to be included in the group of suspects. Seven of these were now dead, and several had now reached a respectable old age. Blomqvist was not willing to share Wanger's conviction that a family member was behind Harriet's disappearance. A number of others had to be added to the list of suspects. Dirk Froder began working for Wanger as his lawyer in the spring of 1962. And aside from the family, who were the servants when Harriet vanished? Gunnar Nielsen, alibi or not, was 19 years old, and his father Magnus was in all likelihood present on Hedeby Island, as were the artist Norman and the pastor Falk. Was Falk married? The Ustergården farmer Aronsson, as well as his son Jerka Aronsson, lived on the island, close enough to Harriet Wanger while she was growing up. What sort of relationship did they have? Was Aronsson still married? Did other people live at that time on the farm? As Blomqvist wrote down all the names, the list had grown to 40 people. It was 3:30 in the morning, and the thermometer read -6°F. He longed for his own bed on Bellmansgarten. He was awoken by the workman from Telia. By 11 he was hooked up and no longer felt quite as professionally handicapped. On the other hand, his own telephone remained stubbornly silent. He was starting to feel quite pig-headed, and would not call the office. He switched on his email program and looked rapidly through the nearly 350 messages sent to him over the past week. He saved a dozen. The rest were spam or mailing lists that he subscribed to. The first email was from democrat88@yahoo.com. "I hope you suck cock in the slammer, you fucking commie pig." He filed it in the intelligent criticism folder. He wrote to erica.berger@millennium.se. "Hi, Ricky. Just to tell you that I've got the networking and can be reached when you can forgive me. Hedeby is a rustic place, well worth a visit. M." When it felt like lunchtime, he put his iBook in his bag and walked to Suzanne's Bridge Café. He parked himself at his usual corner table. Suzanne brought him coffee and sandwiches, casting an inquisitive glance at his computer. She asked him what he was working on. For the first time, Blomqvist used his cover story. They exchanged pleasantries. Suzanne urged him to check with her when he was ready for the real revelations. "I've been serving Wanger's for 35 years, and I know most of the gossip about that family," she said, and sashayed off to the kitchen. With children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, whom he had not bothered to include, the brothers Frederik and Johan Wanger had approximately 50 living offspring today. The family had a tendency to live to a ripe old age. Frederik Wanger lived to be 78, and his brother Johan to 72. Of Frederik's sons, who were yet alive, Harold was 92 and Henrik was 82. The only exception was Gustav, who died of lung disease at the age of 37. Wanger had explained that Gustav had always been sickly and had gone his own way, never really fitting in with the rest of the family. He never married and had no children.
The others who had died young had succumbed to other factors than illness. Richard Wanger was killed in the Winter War, only 33 years old. Gottfried Wanger, Harriet's father, had drowned the year before she disappeared, and Harriet herself was only 16. Mikhail made note of the strange symmetry in that particular branch of the family. Grandfather, father, and daughter had all been struck by misfortune. Richard's only remaining descendant was Martin Wanger, who, at 54, was still unmarried. But Wanger explained that his nephew was a veritable hermit with a woman who lived in Hederstadt. Blomqvist noted two factors in the family tree. The first was that no Wanger had ever divorced or remarried, even if their spouse had died young. He wondered how common that was, in terms of statistics. Cecilia Wanger had been separated from her husband for years, but apparently they were still married. The other peculiarity was that whereas Frederick Wanger's descendants, including Henrik, had played leading roles in the business and lived primarily in or near Hederstadt, Johann Wanger's branch of the family, which produced only daughters, had married and dispersed to Stockholm, Malmö, and Göteborg, or abroad. And they only came to Hederstadt for summer holidays or the more important meetings. The single exception was Ingrid Wanger, whose son, Gunnar Kalman, lived in Hederstadt. He was the editor-in-chief of the Hederstadt Courier. Thinking as a private detective might, Wanger thought that the underlying motive for Harriet's murder might be found in the structure of the company, the fact that early on he had made it known that Harriet was special to him. The motive might have been to harm Wanger himself, or perhaps Harriet had discovered some sensitive information concerning the company and thereby became a threat to someone. These were mere speculations. Nevertheless, in this manner he had identified a circle consisting of 13 individuals whom he considered to be of potential interest. Blomqvist's conversation with Wanger the day before had been illuminating on one other point. From the start, the old man had talked to Blomqvist about so many members of his family in a contemptuous and denigrating manner. It struck him as odd. Blomqvist wondered whether the patriarch's suspicions about his family had warped his judgment in the matter of Harriet's disappearance, but now he was starting to realize that Wanger had made an amazingly sober assessment. The image that was emerging revealed a family that was socially and financially successful, but in all the more ordinary aspects was quite clearly dysfunctional. Henrik Wanger's father had been a cold, insensitive man who sired his children and then let his wife look after their upbringing and welfare. Until the children reached the age of 16, they barely saw their father except at special family gatherings when they were expected to be present, but also invisible. Henrik could not remember his father ever expressing any form of love, even in the smallest way. On the contrary, the son was often told that he was incompetent and was the target of devastating criticism. Corporal punishment was seldom used, it wasn't necessary. The only times he had won his father's respect came later in life, through his accomplishments within the Wanger Corporation. The oldest brother, Richard, had rebelled. After an argument, the reason for which was never discussed in the family, the boy had moved to Uppsala to study. There had been sown the seeds of the Nazi career which Wanger had already mentioned, and which would eventually lead to the Finnish trenches. What the old man had not mentioned previously was that two other brothers had had similar careers. In 1930, Harold and Gregor had followed in Richard's footsteps to Uppsala. The two had been close, but Wanger was not sure to what extent they had spent time with Richard. It was quite clear that the brothers all joined Per Engdahl's fascist movement, the New Sweden. Harold had loyally followed Per Engdahl over the years, first to Sweden's National Union, then to the Swedish Opposition Group, and finally the New Swedish Movement after the war. Harold continued to be a member until Engdahl died in the 90s, and for certain periods he was one of the key contributors to the hibernating Swedish fascist movement. Harold Wanger studied medicine in Uppsala and landed almost immediately in circles that were obsessed with race hygiene and race biology. For a time he worked at the Swedish Race Biology Institute, and as a physician he became a prominent campaigner for the sterilization of undesirable elements in the population. Quote, Henrik Wanger, tape 2, 02950.
Harold went even further. In 1937 he co-authored, under a pseudonym, thank God, a book entitled The People's New Europe. I didn't find this out until the 70s. I have a copy that you can read.
It must be one of the most disgusting books ever published in the Swedish language. Harold argued not only for sterilization, but also for euthanasia, actively